Good morning. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine, and this is Get the Funk Out. If you're not familiar with my show, you can head over to the show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. I do want to mention, before I kick off today's show with my guests who are standing by, it is Juneteenth, and this marks the day in 1865 that enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, found out they had been freed after the end of the Civil War and 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And it was designated a federal holiday in 2021. Juneteenth has become universally recognized beyond Black America. Many people get the day off work or school, and there are a ton of street festivals and fairs and concerts and other things. I know there's a lot going on here in Irvine if you Google it. And later on, I'll put some events up on my show blog. I do want to say a couple other things. If you go to the show blog, there is a link for those who are not familiar with the whole backstory and the meaning behind Juneteenth. So that show blog again is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. So standing by to join me is Dr. Nina Gilbo, and she's here to talk about her new book, The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. Good morning, Dr. Gilbo.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling in.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, I have not eaten meat probably at least 15 years, maybe more. And my dad, which I didn't tell you this, he had stage 4 colon cancer. And I know after he passed, I made a conscious effort to just think about like what could impact my health and well-being. Yeah, I could tell that things were not right with him for a long time. So I'm interested in diving into why you decided to write this book.
Well, you know, I had a very similar story to yours, actually. It was my grandfather who died prematurely from cancer and diabetes. And that experience is really what inspired me to look at the link between diet and disease. And that actually inspired me to change my entire dissertation topic. So at the time, I was a student at Harvard University. I was doing my PhD in sociology. And I became really interested in this movement around eating, you know, less meat, and really for the health reasons, but also the environmental and ethical reasons. And so I ended up doing my entire dissertation topic around, you know, the rise of this movement. The book really comes out of the dissertation, but it's a broader meditation on this question of, you know, what is an ethical way to eat? Is there truly one way to eat? And I really dive into that question because it turns out that very simple question is actually, you know, quite complex.
Sure.
And doesn't have a simple answer. Mm. And so, you know, really for me, the gateway was, I think, in the beginning for veganism, it was health, but I became very interested in the other aspects of this movement as well.
Yeah. And I'm sorry about your grandfather. It's so interesting how the passing of someone so special can change the trajectory of our lives.
Absolutely. I didn't expect it. If you had asked me, you know, would you have ever become vegan? You know, I actually was born in the Soviet Union. I grew up in Canada. We ate a lot of meat, dairy, and eggs in my lifetime. And so if somebody had told me that I would be vegan one day, I would never believe them. But I think, you know, a tragedy like you experienced and what I experienced, mm-hmm. It really does shift, you know, the perspective on life itself and really thinking about quality of life as opposed to just, you know, quantity, of course, but quality of life as well.
Yes. One thing, well, so many things were really fascinating in your book, but you talk about the link with dairy and prostate cancer. I had to cut out dairy a long time ago for health reasons. But can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Dairy is kind of controversial because there's kind of mixed evidence about its health benefits. But primarily in the West, where we overconsume dairy, and, you know, it's also something where, you know, certain people, especially of, you know, people of European descent can typically digest it better, and most people from other parts of the world are dairy intolerant. I myself am also lactose intolerant, mm-hmm. so it's actually quite common. But I think the mix of results comes from the fact that some dairy is beneficial in places where people don't have access to, you know, calcium, essentially. But basically in Western culture, in the most of the countries that we're talking about, there, you know, there's absolutely an overconsumption. And when you think about a dairy, like we think of it so normalized, but really it's the milk that is, you know, supposed to get a cow to grow, very quickly, a calf to grow from calf to full-grown cow very quickly. And it's not actually for humans. It's only in the last, few centuries of humanity that we even began to really consume it. And so actually a lot of us have lactose intolerance, which actually manifests as, acne or eczema in my case, or other issues for people. So, there's some controversy around dairy, especially the World Health Organization. There's some controversy around whether it's healthy or not. But I think, I think there is this rise also of dairy-free because people are noticing the effects on health as well.
By the way, I've had eczema my entire life, and when I cut out dairy, it disappeared.
I had eczema, very severe eczema, and it's completely gone since I've gone on a plant-based diet.
Do you find that people around you, maybe your friends or loved ones at first were like, oh, come on, you can't, you don't want to be vegan or, it's not good for you and all that?
Oh, absolutely. I read in the book how, I sort of had an angry vegan phase in the first years when I first became vegan because I just was, really this book is, I'm really trying to write a vegan book for non-vegans, I don't want to preach to the choir. And I really want people to just think more carefully about really like the food chain that leads to their plate. And, it's very threatening, right? So my family, when I first became vegan, they were very against it, very concerned for my health. Luckily for me, they're all plant-based now, which I, didn't expect. But that only happened when I transitioned myself from being this very angry, kind of in-your-face vegan to, I really was. And I think that's why sometimes vegans are unliked, because we can be kind of confrontational. And it comes from a good place. It comes from a place of, wanting to wake people up to the cognitive dissonance of the environmental impact and the ethical impact and the health impact. And that's where I was coming from as well. But, people are really just, they're not drawn to change through criticism and judgment. They're really drawn to change through this notion of abundance and the beauty of the plant kingdom. So I think when I started to talk about it more in that way and really to invite people, cook for them, share meals with them, that's really when it became something that people were more interested in. And I really tried to write this book from that spirit as well. It's really supposed to be for anyone who eats food, really, because, it would be much better if all of us became good eaters, whether or not we're entirely vegan, than if, all of us, just a few of us became very strictly vegan,
It's not, thank you for that, by the way, it's not that you have to do this overnight. Change can be gradual. And I'll be honest with you, there are times I said, I think I'm going to have some salmon. My uncle's from Alaska. I'm going to have some of that salmon. And then it just doesn't make me feel good. And so, you don't have to go completely cold turkey, but you can start building more plant-based meals.
Absolutely. Whether you're veganish or, vegan till six, like Mark Bittman says, who used to be at the New York Times, or my mentor, Michael Pollan, says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And I think really what we're advocating for is a really significant reduction. When I look at just how much meat, dairy, and eggs are consumed, and actually, even though veganism is on the rise, the consumption of meat is also on the rise. They're actually parallel and they don't cancel each other out. They're kind of parallel trends. And so we're still eating a lot of dairy products. And I think my emphasis in the book is really, if it's against anything, it's actually against factory farming. And that's where I think we can all agree whether or not we're, 100% vegan. And I have a whole chapter in the book about regenerative agriculture and the importance of how our plants and also, animals are grown and so on. So if all of us, are plant-based most of the week, but then some of us eat, grass-fed beef once a week, I think we can live in that world. It's just that I feel there's always this emphasis on, what's going to be taken away from your plate. And as I said, I really want to focus less on what's being taken away and what's being added, what's actually being, this beautiful, nourishing food and how, the impact that it has. I think also, as you said, it didn't make you feel good on a physical level, it sounds like, but I've also, something I've really meditated on is, Wendell Berry, who's a novelist, poet, and a farmer, he is famous for saying that eating is an agricultural act. And it is, but I also believe that it's a spiritual act. So it can also make us feel a lot better to just be in alignment with our own values, including, how we treat other beings on the earth, how we treat the earth itself. And I think it can really make us feel kind of morally more aligned internally. And that's something that I didn't expect from adopting a plant-based diet, is that kind of inner peace around my consumption.
Definitely. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Nina Gilbo about her new book, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food, The Good Eater. One thing that really struck me, too, is that you talk about these fake meats, and there's so many different products that are out right now. I don't eat them personally. Meat alternatives, mm-hmm. and consequences. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I personally don't eat them either. I tend toward eating real plants, mm-hmm. and I really feel like, you know, the more we can eat, you know, things that are grown in the earth,
yes.
the better.
Yes.
But that being said, you know, I talk in the book, and I really, as you could probably tell, I wrestle in the book with this, because on one hand, I really think that from an ethical standpoint, I think they can make a dent, and from an environmental standpoint, but just from a health standpoint, I want to be, you know, clear that these alternative meats, and there's sort of two camps. The camp that most people are familiar with is plant-based, and that, you know, that's beyond meat, that's impossible foods, these kind of processed foods, vegan items. And they are processed foods. I mean, I think they don't really deserve the health halo that surrounds them.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I want to situate them within this broader argument that's often made, which is this idea that, you know, they're processed, but then, you know, meat that we buy at the grocery store is just one ingredient. And that's not true either, because most of the meats that we eat, you know, from grocery stores are grown on factory farms, and so that means they're chock full of hormones, the antibiotics that are preemptively given to animals on factory farms, ammonia, even feces sometimes, there's remnants, and of course, carcinogenic compounds as well. So, you know, I feel like if we're comparing, like, a burger you're going to buy at Kroger with, like, Beyond Meat, I still think the Beyond Meat is better, right? But
yes.
If we're comparing Beyond Meat to, like, a farro salad with, you know, like, some kind of delicious citrus vinaigrette, that's
I know.
Very different. So, you know, I would love for people to focus on beans and legumes, mm-hmm. and grains, which are really the cornerstones of every world cuisine. I mean, if you think about what all of our collective grandmothers used to eat, you know, meat was always a very small part of those meals, and
yes.
it really was much more like deliciously, you know, spiced and prepared foods and made with a lot of love. And that's really, I think, how we used to eat. And it's only in the last, you know, 50 to 70 years that we're actually eating factory farmed animal products 3 times a day. And that's just,
wow.
that's just untenable,
yes.
on any level,
yes.
environmentally and so on, ethically. You know, billions of land animals, trillions of aquatic creatures. So it's, you know, I'm really, what I'm advocating for, if anything, is a kind of, rather than for a future of food with these new technologies, more of like a return to a past of food, a way that we used to eat.
Yes, definitely. And once you start, you know, you mentioned things that I eat. I eat a lot of beans, and I also love sweet potatoes. And I remember watching the Dan Buettner documentary, Purple Sweet Potatoes, right?
Yes.
I feel like everybody watched that, went out and bought them.
You know what's funny? That's my favorite food, is Okinawan sweet potatoes.
Oh.
And I eat them all the time. They're the best fast food, too, because if you just bake them, like, they're delicious. They're full of, you know, all these amazing nutrients.
Yes.
And they're just so, so good. Yeah, they're my favorite food. People actually joke because they're like, you know, very high percentage of my diet.
Me too. I mean, my family would make fun of me because I would just I'd make one and then be eating it like an apple, you know, just like, oh, there she is eating her cold sweet potato, you know.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll definitely get along.
I know.
That's exactly
what
I do.
That's so funny. I know what to bring you as a present.
Yes, likewise.
It's one thing I wrote down that I want to mention is that you talk about processed meats fit into the same category as smoking tobacco and asbestos. I remember being little, I grew up in Connecticut, New York, and my mom saying that certain things like processed meats or those hot dogs had sodium nitrites, and that was a carcinogenic. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't realize at the time, but now, you know, it makes so much sense when you think about colon cancer or other cancers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, exactly. So the World Health Organization declared that essentially that there was sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity of processed meat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it uses the word probably because it's very politically, I mean, basically it's technically a correlation, not a causation, but the correlation is so strong. It's as strong as asbestos or these other things that we basically know cause cancer. Obviously meat does have some nutrients, and you know, I have to admit, even though I, you know, you know, vegans sometimes don't want to admit this, but of course, like, we are omnivores. We have always consumed, you know, foods from the animal, plant, and fungal kingdoms. But just the amount of meat and also the type of meat, like, nowadays we can't get the kind of meat that we used to actually eat in evolutionary history. Some of the paleo advocates, you know, try to eat, like, you know, meat that's supposedly, like, from a different time. But the reality is that the vast majority of us are not getting that kind of meat. And so, yes, I mean, we can literally say that it's carcinogenic and probably even non-processed meat. So there are definitely carcinogenic compounds in meat and has some nutrients, of course, and played a really important role in our evolutionary history. But, you know, we're talking about, like, eating 1% to 5% of our diet as being meat rather than, you know, what it is now, which is much higher.
Could you also talk about regenerative, I'm not even saying it right, agriculture?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, when I first came to Berkeley after finishing my PhD at Harvard, I didn't know what this term was, but I did know that a lot of the people in the regenerative agriculture camp were not fans of veganism. They actually criticized it a lot. And at the time, I didn't really understand why, but really, regenerative agriculture refers to essentially kind of organic practices, and the emphasis often is on soil health. Mm-hmm. But it's often associated with grass-fed beef. So there's a kind of argument for, you know, having animals raised on land where they actually eat grass, which the vast majority of factory-farmed animals don't because they eat feedlot corn and soy. And so there's this emphasis on, like, different types of farming practices that actually regenerate the soil rather than deplete it, which is how we, you know, mostly grow our plants and even just, like, the cattle have better lives for the most part. But the reason that they were critical of veganism is because I think there's this perception of veganism as being very much like the fake meat.
Yes.
And often, you know, vegans really don't care that much about health. They just care about the ethical part piece or the environmental piece. So I always say I'm like a vegan who also really cares about regeneratively grown food and how, you know, organic food and so on. And I think that's an unusual place to be. But what was interesting to me is when I did more research on regenerative agriculture, it just became so clear to me that rather than being enemies of veganism, they actually have so much in common because they both emphasize meat reduction. And actually, for grass-fed beef to even be realistic with the amount of land and resources that we have, we cannot consume meat at the level that we're currently consuming it. So, you know, we would have to basically really reduce meat consumption to even have more grass-fed beef for everyone. And so if that was the case, we would all have to eat grass-fed beef like once a week or once a month, you know. So in my view, it's actually like they're very compatible visions. And that's really what I write about in the book. There's a lot more I can say about that. But regenerative agriculture is a really exciting, I think, new field, and I'm curious to see how in the future, hopefully, those two movements will kind of see a synthesis.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to also mention that while you were at UC Berkeley, you co-founded Plant Futures, the educational nonprofit. What's going on with that now? Because I know you have all kinds of things like the Challenge Lab.
That's right, yes. So I co-founded Plant Futures with a few friends of mine, and we're really proud of it. It's essentially what we do is we link students to opportunities in the plant-based sector, and essentially we're trying to get students to become interested in working in, you know, regenerative agriculture, in, like, vegan companies, but really, like, companies that are really trying to change the food system rather than just kind of make the latest product, but really try to change from the inside out. And the Challenge Lab is a really exciting program that I helped start and also taught that Challenge Lab last year, this past year, and it brings together students on teams with a mentor, a representative from like a partner company or organization. And we've had really fantastic projects where students from many different multidisciplinary backgrounds, including, you know, a business student with a public health student with economics and so on a team strategizing, working together with a client and actually delivering a project that is useful for that organization or company at the end of the semester. So it's a really kind of hands-on, entrepreneurial, innovative course. And it was a lot of fun to teach.
That's fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like us to know about the book?
I hope that readers are inspired to read it who, you know, aren't necessarily vegan. And, you know, I really invite just folks who are interested in becoming more, you know, conscious eaters. And the term good eater, what it refers to is not just eating more ethically and, you know, thinking about the impact on the environment, but also more deliciously and more, you know, with a sense of abundance. And I really, that's the kind of energy of the book, and that's the kind of invitation, is to really kind of go on this journey and ask this very fundamental question that the spiritual teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, he asks in the book, how to eat. He says, what shall I eat today? And he kind of reminds us that what we're really asking when we ask that question is, what kind of world do we want to live in? So this book is a meditation on that question, and I invite readers to join me along and see what they learn.
I love that. And the book is available everywhere books are sold. I know it's on Amazon and pretty much everywhere.
That's right.
It's
everywhere you get books. And, of course, I love local bookstores. And please leave a review. And actually, the audiobook is coming out on June 25th. It's in a few days.
Very exciting. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've really enjoyed having you on. Congratulations on this very important book.
Thank you so much, and I hope we can have some sweet potatoes together someday.
I would love that. Are you doing any workshops or speaking engagements?
I actually have an event coming up at the Harvard Bookstore with my mentor, Michael Pollan, October 10th, and so I'm very excited about that. It's just kind of a homecoming to come back to Harvard and also do a talk with him. I feel very honored. So if anyone is in the Cambridge, Boston area, okay. I would love for them to come.
Fantastic.
And then we might have some other events we'll see in the fall.
Okay, great. Sounds good. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Wonderful to meet you. Take care.
That was Dr. Nina Gilbo talking about her new book, The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. If you missed any part of this, the show will be up as a podcast within an hour after I wrap. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and I'm Janine. This is Get the Funk Out.